If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grime America Show. Coming at you with William Warwick, going back to our roots somewhat. We had our first episode was about the stains on Mars and Phobos, and this one we'll go back to talking about Mars and Phobos. I mean, some interesting stuff. I didn't know the Cycladian rhythm thing. And we got Grandma Cycladium Dunlop here, everybody's favorite podcaster, stay-at-home podcaster.
Yeah, the Phobos Enigma. Evidence of artificial nuclear pulse detonation on Phobos. Kind of makes a case for Phobos and Deimos, I think, being together at some point. And they're both on the edge of the... It does really seem made up. Like, it's been engineered this way. They're both on the edge of the Roche limits, which is kind of weird. Yeah.
Roche limit again.
Interesting book, yeah. What was I going to say about this, too?
What's the Roche limit?
The Roche.
Roche. What's a Roche?
I wonder if it has something to do with the Roche burning down, you know? What is a Roche? Oh, I think it's when the limit of when you will fall back into Earth or something like that, maybe. And the other limit is when you will be, like, the Roche limit is probably that limit of, like,
Perfect little speed you're at so that you don't fall in or fall out of orbit.
Yeah. So there's, I think one of these moons is on the very edge of that side and the other one's on the other side. So kind of interesting as well.
It is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good chat. Interesting book. Lots of pictures in his book.
I haven't seen the book. Do you have the hard copy or the ebook?
No, just the ebook. I don't know if it's out for sale, actually, but I've got his Facebook.com here, WikiLeaks UFOs. There's a note in the show notes there. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker, produce writer, and inventor. His work has been featured on Ancient Aliens, Alien Con, Coast to Coast, ABC News, and many others. His book is the Phobos one I talked about. This is the first book being published since Coast to Coast was his first radio interview in 2007, and he had another book out, I think, called, I'm going to read the title of that one, because it's about the Phoenix Lights. We were trying to set up this to be on a Phoenix Lights anniversary, which was March 13th, so, I mean, we didn't even really get into that much, but let me just quickly read the title of his book on the Phoenix Lights. I mean, that is an interesting UFO case, I think, that'll... It'll go down. It stood the test of time. I think it'll go down in history as one of the big
Phoenix
ones.
Phoenix Lights?
Yeah, his book. Wow, his book has 607 ratings on it. The Phoenix Incident is his book. Was it an advanced military craft or was it from somewhere else in the universe? So that's his thing. Yeah. Yeah, the Phoenix Lights. Yeah. In the 90s. Remember that happening at all?
Phoenix Lights in the 90s. I do remember that. Even the mayor was like saying some shit, right? And then there's like some black kids out there like, yo, where is this? There's like a bunch of people, I think. Wasn't it like hundreds of people seen that shit?
Yeah. It was, massive. Yeah. And they tried to say it was flares. And then it was like, no, it wasn't flares. Yeah.
So you think that is still relevant? You think that's because no one's talking about it anymore, really? Is it still relevant in the biz?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Huh.
I just don't think it's ever been properly debunked. There's so much evidence out there that people saw this massive, massive craft, like miles long, I think, with the lights and stuff. So it's kind of one of those. I love the ones about the big craft. Like you see like sightings of an aircraft that's the size of a football field or the size of a small town or the, you know, I find those fascinating. Some of those so crazy dreams I've had sort of with alien ET battles, like almost like a sci-fi dream, have had like massive UFOs in them like that. So I just find that part fascinating.
Yeah. There you have it.
What's going on, man? You shot something? I saw the video. It made me sad.
Oh, I figured that was a hell of a video, Jesse.
Oh, my God. I was like, I watched that. I'm like, I'm just going to become vegan, I think, after that.
I didn't even know he took the video, but he showed it to me after. And I was like, oof, that's a good one. You knew which one I was going to shoot.
So, where'd you hit it?
You know, it went through the lungs and the heart and the back shoulder. Maybe the front shoulder, maybe both shoulders. I mean,
what was that again? Animal?
It was an antelope.
Antelope?
A pronghorn.
Pronghorn, yeah, pretty big one.
It was decent. Yeah, decent. We got it all dealt with in the day. Got it from hoof to freezer, which was good. So, yeah, it was a good day. Nice day on the plains. But that chasing partridge around. Man, I think we shot that, I don't know, by 8:30 in the morning or something like that. It wasn't even 9 yet. Because we were supposed to go on the goose hunt, but it got canceled last minute. So we were like, well, fuck. And decided to go antelope hunting because I'm almost out of antelope. It's a kid's favorite. So, you know, I'm almost out of all sorts of shit. I got to go and get a elk or a moose soon, so because you know what, I'm almost out of the steaks and stuff, and that's really the best part is all the steaks. So 'tis about time.
Yeah.
So it was a good hunt. Got the truck out. I got the truck running and the stereo in it and the hands free and all that kind of stuff. So that was a good test for it to take it out all day. And
it ran good.
Yeah, ran good because it's like an hour and 20 minutes to the hunting ground, and then we drove that fucker around all day up some crazy hills out in the field and didn't have any trouble. No trouble at all.
That's good.
Yeah, so good sign. Got first blood in it. Seems to be running well. So I'm happy. Oh, man, it's so cheap to run. It's fucking crazy.
What? The diesel? Just that much of a difference?
Oh, dude, it's fucking half.
Really? Wow. That's good. Well, that's good.
Maybe if it's not half, it's like close, you know, like 55-60%. More than that for sure, more than 60 or less than 60 for sure, whichever way you do that ratio. I probably used to be worse when diesel was expensive, but diesel's now down to almost the same price as gas here. They're pretty much, there's like a 4 cent difference between the two of them.
And it just goes that much more on it then?
When this thing came out back in the day, diesel was probably like fucking 49 cents. I mean, you would have been able to drive this truck forever for almost nothing. I fill it up for $120 and drive it for, you know, I'll get almost 1,000 kilometers.
When was that? What year was that then?
It's an 06.
It's 06? Oh, you still got a newer one than me. I got an 02.
Oh, did you? Yeah, it's the 06 Mega Cab Cummins. 24
06 Mega Cab Cummins. So it's a Ford?
No, it's a Dodge. Dude, the inside's even bigger than my last one.
Really? I didn't know they had big ones back then.
It's got to be like the first one. It's like the same size as the last one, but then there's a huge behind the seat too. So like almost all the stuff out of my other truck, they almost all fit just behind the seat of the.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you can fit four guys in there plus a bunch of stuff behind the seats and then in the back too.
Yeah, and the
how box. Long is a box pretty big or?
A foot longer. It's 6 foot seven.
Holy, well, that's great too.
It's 6'4". I think it's.
But that's seven. Good too, right? Isn't it? Because isn't some of the boxes now just super small?
Yeah, my other one was 5'7". It was a foot shorter.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
You can get the 8 foot, but then if you have the 8 foot and the mega cab, it's a lot of truck. To be driving around in parking lots and shit like that. Yeah.
Totally. You get back out, you got to go. It's got to squeeze all the way to the end of every parking spot you're in because you're sticking out.
Yeah. This one here, honestly, you know, as big as it looks, it drives identical to every truck. You know, I've been driving Dodges for a decade or over a decade, about a decade. So, you know, it drives the same. I mean, the tires are pretty big. So it got cut. I did hit the curb in the drive through. McDonald's has a stupid tight ass drive through where I get coffee. And it might just be it
barely makes the turn on that, I bet.
Yeah. So anyway, that's
well, that's good. So that's your new hunting truck, your new old hunting truck and stuff. That's good. Yeah, good. Awesome.
Highway ham for hammer and highway miles too.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah, I got that done, got some hunting done. That's that's pretty much all I did all week. I bought that thing, the day after the last show, I think, right?
Oh, I don't know. I'm all screwed up with time right now and stuff. Like,
yeah. I think I bought it the day after the last show. And then basically it's just, it needed to, I had to do control arms and stereo and the fuse blown. I wasn't connected to where it was supposed to be. So that took a while to figure out. Got it all done and even got a backup camera on it. So
what did you put in there? Did you put like an aftermarket stereo that's basically like a receiver for your phone then, like a Bluetooth receiver type thing, or can you plug it in as well?
That same Apple Play one. So it's the exact same interface as on my last two trucks.
Oh, okay.
Except you can just buy it. It was like $250. Just pop it in, man. It took a minute.
I was
chasing some electrical gremlins down, and then there was an aftermarket stereo in it from before that's half worked and half didn't, and there's a couple blown speakers. So,
oh my god, that's a big project. Yeah,
rip the doors off and run new speaker wire.
No way. Oh man, yeah.
It's a lot of work, man. It's like, you know, nothing happens fast.
Oh, yeah. These days, especially with the old newer cars, I'm sure like back in the 80s, we did that a lot quicker.
Well, you know what it is. It's just once you dig into something like that, once you dig into some 20-year-old shit, it's like, oh, this fucking bolt is stuck or this is, you know, you just start, it's just one fucking problem to another. But you get through it as long as you, I mean, dude, when I did those control arms, I went through like fucking a dozen Sawzall blades because all the bolts are seized. So I'm in there with the Sawzall fucking going and the blades are breaking to get the old one. Wow. And you get in there and you're like, how the fuck? How the fuck is that ever supposed to fucking happen? But, you know, you just got to go for it. You just got to not be overwhelmed by the situation.
Yeah, totally. Just pick your way through each problem. A lot of problem solving, right? I was telling you, because I'm building this wall for a new bathroom down here, trying to, you know, pick away at some more rentals here. And it's just like little tiny things, you know, just problem solve with these little things, right? How do you build a, you know, a buck out or like a, how do you go around that pipe or this and that and trying to keep it square without like, you know, keep it tight and square. Then I realized afterwards my door frame is not in the right spot at all. Like it's like, you know, there's a bulge in the center because I've got it around the string or the stairs. And so luckily I caught that. So I got to make it at least the door width. Otherwise, then I can shim the door frame afterwards. Right. So a little just, yeah, it's fun to get into some of the projects with your hands and troubleshoot them and, you know, solve little tiny problems along the way.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So
was the control arms were messed up to begin with, or and did you know that when you bought it and you knew you had to do that work, or?
Well, it came. The guy who had it had one set done.
Oh, okay, yeah, I thought I saw
new grease on aftermarket ones, so I didn't want them to be different. And it was kind of shaking too on the highway when you get up to speed. It's shaking around a bit because
now it feels better.
Yeah, one set of control arms is probably a little bit shorter. Or a little bit longer than the other one. I mean, it's good. It's like back to, I don't know my diesels, but I know vehicles. Like it's back to that point before they were so crazy that it's like, the, you know, I kind of know my way around it. And it's way up off the ground a little bit. So like you can crawl around underneath there and do some stuff.
Lift? You got a lift on there too?
It's got a 6-inch lift. Yeah. 6-inch. And 35-inch tires.
Just a monster truck.
It's a res rocket. Oh, it'd be tall for you. You wouldn't be able to see in the window, bro. You wouldn't be able to see in the window. The kids dig it, though.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. That's good.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's what I got. And got rid of my new truck. That's gone. Left today.
No payments.
No more payments.
That's awesome.
I think I have one more like $300 payment or something, and that's it. And I'm out. So yeah, good stuff. I mean, that's grandamerica.ca/support. If you can, when you can, would be a great way to support us. And this is our job. This is the bacon. It's got to bring home the bacon. So if you guys are watching,
taking the leaps of faith here.
Yeah. Selling stuff now. So grandamerica.ca/support. If you can, when you can, sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation, and we'll make a Lord out of you or a...
I went through that last summer. I sold all my D&D books, like a collection of them, for like $1,000.
The quick thou, you were able to rustle up a quick $1,000.
It was probably the summer before last summer, I think.
I was going to get a Republic of Alberta flag made. They wanted $239 for it or something. So I just got an Alberta flag from the Canadian Tire for $12. And it's funny because I just got it like 4 days ago or 5 days ago or something like that. And now we're going to separate. I'll just spray paint Republic on it or something like that.
You could probably have one printed. I bet you.
At having one printed. It was fucking $239.
Oh, that's. Really?
Wow. From Vistaprint.
Because that banner I print, so I have a banner for our A-list channel that I can put behind me, and the Grimerica banner and the Grimerica Outlawed and the Adult Brain banner, and they're only like $95 each to do the banner, so that seems expensive to do the flag from Vistaprint.
Yeah.
Did you try a local printer? Or?
I didn't try the local printer, and I don't know how good of quality the flag was either.
You know what? When I used to work there with you, we had a printer. That guy was awesome. He was he used to print all the drawings for us and all that. You should go see him. Actually, he printed up a lot of stuff for Grimerica. That's who I used to get to print up our magnets for the truck. SurePrint.
Yeah. SurePrint. Yeah.
Check him out.
He does flags. Get a Republic of Alberta flag.
He does all kinds of stuff. You know, these printers, they do all kinds of stuff. So yeah, maybe.
I assume we would just go with the same flag and just put Republic. Maybe we don't even need to put Republic of Alberta on it.
Well, that sounds good. You should do that, because that smells, or that sounds like separation, you know.
It's cool, man. So I'm like Mel Gibson in Braveheart.
Yeah, I didn't really see it. Our provinces they're pretty blue. There's
I don't think I ever seen
as blue as he can get right now.
I don't think I ever seen as all of Braveheart. It's so long, right? Is that super long?
I think so, yeah.
Anyway, speaking of thanking donations, if you do donate, we'll mention it. We got Trevor Lohman to thank this week.
Trevor, thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Trevor. He said, hey, guys, I sent a couple of signed copies of my book to the P.O. Box. It's called God's Eye View. I'm a medical school professor and neuroscience researcher challenging the mainstream orthodoxy. I think it'll be up your alley. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, we got to have him back on the show too again, because he's been on the show once.
Was he on the show?
Yeah.
When was that?
A few years ago. So we should have him back on and talk about the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll let you know when the book gets in. I got quite a care package building up for you here as well. So someone else just sent two books.
Well, I wonder the next time you come east, can't you come east a little bit further and like go an hour further, and I'll come a few hours.
That big red blob up there. I don't know if I want to come up that way.
What red blob? What?
Yeah, you're from like liberal.
No, not that. South. Stay on the freeway.
How far are you from the border of red?
3 hours for red.
Yeah,
a red. Oh, let me check. That's a good question. I mean, I don't even actually, to be honest with you, I don't even know how I would find that out. Do they have borders? Like, how do you see the border on the? Darren's talking about the election from last night. There was one big riding, basically northern Saskatchewan, one big riding that turned red, but all the rest, even the cities, are blue. So the prediction was correct for Saskatchewan. Like, the polls were correct. Even though they probably got that part wrong, but they were correct for the number.
I don't know why the Indians keep voting for the liberals. I mean, they just keep fucking them over. It's unbelievable to me.
Yeah. Well, it's all the
money.
Oh, I don't want to
get money. The money.
I'm a ways away. Yeah, I'm a ways away.
There's a storm brewing outside.
Yeah.
I wonder, you always have to be wondering about tornadoes around here, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't seen one in a long time. What's the weather? No warnings. So it's supposed to be, dude, it's supposed to be, guess what, how, what the temperature is supposed to be here this weekend?
22.
28.
No way.
Yeah. Seems like a bit much, huh?
That seems like a lot. Yeah, that seems like global warming right there.
Global warming is a motherfucker. That's how they get you. Anyway, what else? Do we got anything else to get to?
Yeah, Cosmic Summit. So, oh no, you got to keep thanking our lords and ladies. And
I got one.
So you got, okay.
Motherfucker. That's it.
And I interrupted you when you were doing your spiel. So you're talking about the lords and the peasants and the serfs and all that.
Yeah, support us. And you could be not a serf, not a pleb, not a peasant. You could become a noble just with one donation of any amount or sign up for a monthly any amount. Bam, noble, Grand American. And then if you sign up for enough that you get to 1,000 one day, you'd be a lord of Grand America or a lady. And 10 grand gets you godhood. So, you know, something to think about. GrandAmerica.ca/support. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. Stop being a pleb, you know, plebiscite.
Be our first deity.
Be our first deity. One fucking one shot.
Bam. CosmicSummit.com. We are both going to Cosmic Summit. It's going to be a party.
God, be an Instagod.
Instagod. Are you, do we have anybody that signed up for the free?
Yeah, at least party? One. Oh, no one told me that they wanted to yet.
Okay. So if you guys, if you're our supporters, we'll bring this down to the noble level. So it's lords and nobles. So anybody that's supported the show, if you want a free streaming pass for Cosmic Summit, which is the world's number one heterodox history gathering, June 20th to 23rd, so a couple months away, let us know and we will get you a free stream pass, a live stream. So send me or Darren an email, graham@grandamerica.com, or Darren, if you've donated to the show, if you want a free pass, just donate. Just make a donate. That's a good little incentive right there. Just make whatever donation you want, and we'll give you the pass.
And you get the pass. Bam. There you go.
So, and it'll help us share the word for this Cosmic Summit. It's looking like they've got a huge lineup of guests here. And if you want to go in person, then that'd be great. Come and see us. But we got Randall Carlson, Ben Van Kirkwick, Robert Schock, Dan Richards, Praveen Mohan, Danny Hillman, Scott Wolter, Tim Hogan, June Newman, Micah Hanks, Bob Greener, Matt Bell, Mark Young, Yusuf from Egypt will be there.
Good to see Yusuf again. Micah Hanks, eh? We meet again.
Ashton Forbes. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be great.
Micah Leftist Hanks.
Yeah.
There you have it, guys. Do you have a bio for William?
No, I read it already, so... Yeah, and check CosmicSummit.com out too.
Bill.
Oh, and use GrimAmerica25 for 10% off, and then we'll get like a little
is it tiny caps?
That. What?
Capital letters, all caps.
I don't think it matters.
Doesn't matter. Use
CosmicSummit.com. When you get your ticket, use GrimAmerica25.
All right, guys, support the show and enjoy the chat with William Warwick. We'll be right back.
All right. William Warwick is with us. Thanks for joining us. We have come full circle from talking about Phobos in 2013. And now we're like episode probably 710 or something like that. And we're going to be talking about it again. So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, this will be fun. We had a, you know, the first thing we did was talking about Mars. And of course, Phobos and the monolith came up. But our original guest way back in 2013 was he spent like hours and hours, days and days going through all the, what was it, Darren, the Mars rover stuff or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's the orbital one.
The orbital one, and piecing together all these pictures of Mars and showing that these are stains of water. And then sure enough, you know, he was vindicated years later. So this is, you know, your book is kind of reminding me of that time. You know, your book is called The Phobos Enigma, Evidence of Artificial Nuclear Pulse Detonation on Phobos.
Yeah, that's the title. We couldn't think of anything shorter that that explained it any better. So we're working on it. If anyone has any suggestions, we'll take it.
No, I like it. I like it. Yeah. It's just, I mean, you're getting right to the point there.
We don't want to leave anything out for our imagination.
So where do we start?
Well, you know, I think a little bit of background for the readers or for the listeners. You know, Mars has two small, they call them moons, but they're not really moon-sized. They're more like asteroids. And the prevailing theory for many years was that they were captured asteroids. We actually didn't discover them until around 1877, I think, roughly, which is kind of unusual. We discovered Neptune and some of the farthest, you know, planets in the solar system, and we couldn't find Phobos and Deimos until 1877. So there's a little bit of a mystery. There's a lot of mystery, I should say, actually. When you look at these two, people call them captured asteroids, but I think obviously the evidence that we're going to present tonight clearly shows that it's not a captured asteroid, at least not a naturally captured asteroid. And I think that's really the key here is looking at all of the anomalous features of these two moons and their relationship to Mars and to each other, and trying to figure out how did these things get where they are? How did they get placed in the orbits that they're in? How is the chemical composition, you know, the cesium and the rest of the radioactive elements that we know are on Mars and most likely on the two moons as well? Where did all these things come from? You know, these are all artificial indicators of something that was, we say artificial because we don't know, right? You know, we're not going to say aliens or this or that or extraterrestrials. We just know that it's not natural. And I think that's the biggest thing. Takeaway that I got out of when I originally investigated this was that, like, there's no way that these things are natural. There's just no way. And so that's why we call it evidence of basically terraforming, you would call it. You know, you're operating on a space level where you're actually taking planetary bodies and moving them around the solar system in order to get, you know, orbits or whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. So that's really the takeaway.
Okay, that's a good background on that. You did mention in your original email to me about evidence of ET, of alien life. Is this part of that, or is that a completely separate topic?
No, I think it is part of it because it's evidence that someone or something had the capability. You know, that's the thing. Of using nuclear pulse detonations to move these asteroids into the place that they're in now, which is an inner or an outer Roche limit, and aerostationary orbit, and the Hohmann transfer orbit, and there's all of these like space things, let's call them space mechanics, right? That we see in satellites. That's really what piqued my interest when I originally began investigating this. Is I started looking at the orbital eccentricity. And the patterns of the orbits and trying to compare them and find an analogy to it, and I couldn't. The only comparisons I could find were actual artificial satellite orbital paths, which were actually not as accurate as like Deimos, for instance. Deimos has an orbital eccentricity, which just basically means whether it's an oval shape or a perfect circle. The orbital eccentricity is like 5 millionths of a degree. So it's 0.0005. It's like we don't even make satellites to put them into space with that degree of accuracy.
Wow.
But yet we have, yeah, you know. So how do we get two separate bodies, you know, orbiting around Mars at pretty much the perfect inner and outer Roche limits, which is the closest you can be to a planet before, you get sucked into the gravity, and then Deimos is in the outer Roche limit, which is as far as you can be before you leave the gravity of the planet. So it's like 6, 7, 8, 9 things. If you have one or two of them, you could say, okay, it's possible. It could be natural. Universe is a big place. And even if it's a billion to one, it's still possible, right? It's like winning a lottery ticket. People win the lottery ticket all the time. But when we ran the odds on it, it actually came out to 1 in 5 trillion. 1 in 5 trillion, which is about 1,000 times more difficult to win the lottery ticket than the 1 in a billion. So it just doesn't.
That's taking them both into account, like this whole scenario, or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All the different anomalies. In fact, in the paper, we show the calculations that we use to come up with that. So it's like orbital eccentricity, Hohmann transfer orbit, aerostationary orbit, inner and outer Roche limits. There's 4. The fifth one was the cesium and the radioactive elements from the Kaidun meteorite. And the Kaidun meteorite itself is evidence. So, and then you have it not just on one planetary body, which is, say, for instance, Phobos, but you have it on 2 planetary bodies. So it's not even like 1 to the 7th times 54, or whatever, you know, whatever the calculation is. It's 2 times 7th to the 54th power, or whatever the calculation is. So, and that's really where it just becomes impossible to say that these are naturally occurring things.
Does this fit in with the whole overall theory of Mars? And what's that scientist, Brandenburg, I think his name is, or?
Oh yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
does it fit in with that whole Mars theory too? That it was, well, sort of blasted nuclear? Like, does this, what happened to those moons fit in with that?
Yeah, absolutely. The only question is going to be, I think, moving forward, is did the cesium and the other radioactive elements come from nuclear pulse detonations on the to move those moons into place, which we know that they did. The evidence is clear that they did. And or was there nuclear explosions on the planet itself, or both? The history of the moon is, I'm sure, not the moon, but Mars is, you know, there's obviously, we have legends and myths to guide us a little bit, but It obviously, it looks to me like there was some kind of event. Maybe there was some warfare or something of that nature, and the planet was struck. You know, there's one gentleman, I believe he calls it the electric arc theory, the electric universe theory, which actually makes a lot of sense. And I actually am I prescribe to some of his theories about how some of the mechanisms work, and how the for instance, like the Valley Marianas, not the Valley Marianas, I can't remember what it's called. But they got the largest canyon in the solar system, and one of their theories, not my theory, another gentleman's theory, is that was actually caused by some kind of close interaction with another planet or a comet, and that caused an electrical arc to actually form between the two, and that's what caused that huge depression like the Grand Canyon. So I do think that there's ample evidence on both areas, both on Mars and the 2 asteroids, to indicate that there is nuclear events, let's call them, right? We don't know if that was an attack, for instance, from a nuclear bomb, or if that was just fallout from positioning the moons into the positions they're in now. It's really difficult to tell. And there's probably a little bit of cross-contamination we might never be able to tell without actually going there and doing archaeological studies in person, so to speak. But yeah, there's definitely, Brandenburg's right. There's no way to really explain that in a natural context.
Did this get you to look at our moon a little closer too? Did it change your view on our moon going through all this research?
It's interesting you brought that up. I have done a bit of research into our moon. It also has some anomalies to it as well. It appears to be hollow, which is really unusual. They did a test after the Apollo missions where they sent one of the landers down, and they basically bounced it off of it, and the thing ran like a bell. Ring like a bell for a couple days, apparently. So I think it's absolutely possible. In fact, if you look at Native American legends, some of them say that the moon was actually brought here, and it's actually populated by, you know, some kind of aliens or ETs. And they specifically say that, like, we're not supposed to go near it or touch it or whatever. And that may be the reason why we really haven't gone back there since 1969, 1974, whatever. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens in these next few years as we branch out back into space and really sort of try to confront these things, right? Because obviously, I think it's hard to say that there are not extraterrestrials or other life out there. I think it's pretty silly to think that there's not at this point. There's so much evidence that points to it. Whether it's water on Mars or, you know, bacteria on panspermia or on asteroids, DNA seems to be, obviously, look at the Earth. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of species on the Earth, all with the same life pattern, which is based on, you know, DNA. So it would be foolish to think that that we won't find it throughout the universe. And it'll probably look something like us. You know, we get expected bipedal, two arms, some kind of, you know, hand structure, and it's just how evolution works. So I'm a firm believer that in time we will find some of these answers, maybe not all of them, but we will find a lot of them. And we'll probably find them on the moon and Mars and Phobos and stuff like that. Kind of retracing our steps, I think, is possible as well. We may be finding the evidence of our own expansion into the civilization. I have a pet theory. We go through it in the book a little bit, where they did experiments. A number of experiments have been done where if you take human beings out of a circadian rhythm, you put them in a cave or something like that where they don't have access to sunlight. And one famous experiment was done in the 1960s, and they found that humans revert back to a 24.6-hour day. Now, the interesting thing about that is, of course, we have a 24-hour day, but Mars has a 24.6-hour day, you know? So it's very interesting that if you take away all other outside indicators that human beings revert back to a Mars day, which is equal to a Mars day. Excuse me. Yeah. So, you know. And not only that, but there's other similarities as well. We have a 23.5 degree tilt, right? Just like Mars. It's less than a degree difference. And the only difference between Mars and Earth is that Mars takes about twice as long to go around the sun. So if you lived on Mars, right, you would still have four seasons. Your day would be 24 hours, but your year would be like 687 days long. So, you know, if and I'm just going to throw this out there, what if we evolved on Mars? What if we originally evolved on Mars and then there was, you know, some kind of some catastrophic events happened and we had to migrate and we came here to the Earth? That would make sense. You know, it might also explain where Phobos and Deimos came from. Like, why did someone go through all the trouble to put Phobos and Deimos where they were? One of the reasons why you would want to put Phobos and Deimos where they are is because they're in the perfect, what's called aerostationary orbits, where you can do what's called a Hohmann transfer. And a Hohmann transfer is a rocket mechanics, basically orbital mechanics, where you basically have, it's the shortest, it's the least amount of fuel that you can use to get from point A, which will be the surface of the planet, to a way station, which will be Phobos, and then you refuel on Phobos and you go to Deimos, and then from Deimos you go to your final destination, which will be the Earth. Now, the reason why we know that these things exist is because we do the same thing here on Earth. We try to put satellites in the Roach inner and outer Roach limits, because if you go any further or any farther away, they crash into the planet, or they go out into space and they lose the gravity. So the question has to be, like, why did someone go through so much effort to put those two moons there? And I think there's a possibility that what happened was there was some kind of evacuation that went on the planet and they came here. As crazy as that sounds, but like the evidence kind of supports that, because we don't know why else they would go to Mars. We assume maybe perhaps for mining purposes, but it certainly seems like, you know, you could mine materials off the surface of the moon. You wouldn't necessarily have to build space stations for that, right? Because you're going in the opposite direction. You're going off the moon instead of onto it. But I do think that there's a mystery there. And this actually segues into the monolith, which I know you guys are probably familiar with. Former astronaut Buzz Aldrin, 2007, 2008, roughly maybe about a year after I did my first presentation, he did a presentation on CNN talking about the monolith, which is a well-known feature actually by now, which is basically something like a 300 foot tall by like 100 foot wide structure, which is protruding out of Phobos. And there's speculation that perhaps that's some kind of, just like you said, a monolith, some kind of like record perhaps, or, you know, time capsule perhaps of what happened. And maybe there's a history there that we'll find someday. And I think it'll probably be the history of the human race, or other races for that matter, possibly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Interesting that Musk is really pushing to get there. So we should find out more. Well, I mean, if we trust all that, I mean, I just heard about the Roche limits today, I think, because of that that all woman flight of Blue Origin that sort of went to the lower limit.
Well,
if they went at all, I mean, I don't know, the door conspiracy is quite interesting, but
well, I think
did you see the patch conspiracy?
Yeah.
No. Upside down patch looks like Baphomet.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Well, I do think though that, like, you know, Bezos and Musk, I think what they're really, you know, they could say that they want to go to Mars, but what they really want to do is they want to go to the asteroid belt. So they're going to use the excuse of going to Mars so that they can be the first to mine those asteroids, because, you know, one of those asteroids could be worth a couple $1 trillion in terms of materials. So, you know, Musk definitely has the advantage in that, because he's creating all these autonomous robots. And of course, that's exactly what you're going to use out in space, is an autonomous robot. And of course, you could use Colossus to basically be the brain of that, and program it and organize it. And I think they can talk all they want about living on Mars, but nobody really wants to live on Mars. It's just not a habitable place right now. Maybe in a couple hundred years we could terraform it, but I think the real reason why they're going after that is actually for the asteroids. They want to mine the asteroids and bring them back.
Well, do you think there's a legitimate reason for, you know, avoiding cataclysm here too? I mean, I do feel like there's a lot of people talking about we're coming up on another, you know, pole flip, or, you know, cometary impact chance, or solar flares, micronovas. I mean, there's all these different theories, but there seems to be a cyclical cataclysm that might affect more than Earth. But what, you know, it seems like, I mean, who knows whether to believe Elon or not, but he's like, we need to get humanity safely in another spot as well. Or could you do that on the asteroid belts as well? Or do you think it's really just about resources?
It's resources.
Yeah.
It's just about resources. I mean,
look, like a sci-fi novel, right? Like Ben Bova. Yeah. There's some really cool sci-fi novels about these massive corporations that are mining asteroids. I should go back and listen to some of those.
No, I mean, it's silly to think that you're going to get any sizable population off the Earth and, you know, to Mars. I mean, think about it, right? You know, I mean, we could barely probably get a couple hundred people there at a cost of maybe a couple hundred billion. So, like, yeah, what's the rescue plan for the other 8 billion people? You know what I mean? I mean, it's a joke, you know? Not a joke, excuse me, but I just, you know, of course they're going to say all these things because they want to get people fired up about it and this, that, and the other thing. And it would be nice to have an escape plan, but I would much rather invest in the Earth and try to save what we have rather than just abandoning it because we destroyed it. You know what I mean? Like, that's not really a plan. That's a suicide plan as far as I'm concerned. So I think these guys should be doubling down on the Earth and not necessarily trying to go out into the solar system and pollute that. And let's fix our own problems before we go and mess up someone else's planet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And contaminate it and everything else. So I think these things will all work themselves out. As far as all the catastrophic cataclysms and stuff like that, yeah, they're coming. But, you know, it's a cyclical thing. If you go back 5,125 years ago, when we had a vast increase in civilization, about 3,125 BC, that's about the time period of the Mayan Bakhtun. We just finished the Bakhtun cycle. So we just recycled it to 13.000 and December 12th. So we're right in the time period where all of these cataclysms, you mentioned solar flares, earthquakes, all of these things are going to come back. And the funny thing is, you know, I spent a lot of time working with the Hopis and the elders for a long time. 8 years I spent with one of the elders, and he confided a lot of things into me and another gentleman named Ronald Ruger. And, you know, if you've got a history that goes back 50,000 years, right? Oral history, and they do have this, by the way, 5,000 years that we know specifically at Orabi. Orabi is the longest continuously occupied city in North America, in the Hopi book, in Arizona. So they have a record of things that go way further back than any book that we have will ever be able to teach us. And they talk about there was an asteroid strike, you know, maybe 50,000 years ago, probably the one that hit Arizona, and they were warned about it, and they went underground with the ant people. And they talk a lot about the ant people and the blue people and the mud people and the orange people. There's six or seven different races that apparently live with us on this planet, underground, in the oceans. And they've been here before we were here, right? So these cataclysms are regular events on every planet. And they have to do with the solar system being in a certain position in relationship to the black hole. Because there's radiation, there's energy that's emanated from the black hole and other parts of around the galaxy. And when the solar system and the sun go into that particular part of the galaxy, so to speak, in relation to the black hole, then we go through this period where we pass through, some people think it's a superpolarized magnetic field. And the energy and the light and the heat from the sun will actually be warped by this polarized magnetic field. And we will have the biblical 3 days of darkness, right? Now, the crazy thing is, you know, most Christians will know that story from the book of Revelations, but it's actually in the Native American stories as well, right? So how do you have these completely two separate, separated by continents, right, in thousands of years of history, and yet they have the same story? So either both of them are working from the same source, which is possible, or they both are recording the same event in different ways, and they're packaging it in different ways. One's a Judeo-Christian story, and the other one's a Native American story.
Well, right? three days is very strange time, because there's hundreds of references in old texts about 3 days. 3 days, you know, 3 days resurrection, 3 days death, 3 days, the sun goes away, 3 days for healing, 3 days fasting, 3 days travel. I mean, all through the ancient text, they use 3 days over and over. So can you just explain that again, the process of what happens for the 3 days darkness, just so I can wrap my head around it?
Well, the timing is not specific. They think it's going to happen soon. They basically, they use timing through signs. Yeah. So they'll say, for instance, like, when you see this, then expect this.
There's omens, sort of omens and superstitions and stuff around it. Yeah.
Well, I think I wouldn't call it omens or superstitions, not at all. What it is you have to understand that, like, the Mayans and a lot of the native, you know, Hopi, for instance, that are really, and they're actually related if you go far enough back, they can see things in their minds through, you know, telepathy and stuff like that, clairvoyance. You know, clairvoyance is just, you know, from Latin, to see clearly, right? So you see clearly in the future. So what they're doing is they can see events, right? But you don't know when that event is. You could say, well, when all of the trees are on fire and, you know, people become, you know, trans and a male wants to be a female and a female wants to be a male. These are the signs that they talk about, right? And they say, when you see these things, then you can expect this, right?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's more of a precog thing. Yeah, yeah. I like that. So,
hold on one second. I just want to get this out there. That's why they can't say with any particular accuracy when it will happen, right? But they may know the sequence of events. So, for instance, there's like 14 separate major events that are supposed to happen before the Great Purification. But depending on which Mesa you talk to and which elder you talk to, we've already fulfilled 12 or 13 out of those 14 signs, right? Basically one major sign left. So we're at that point right now where we're going to go through a purification phase. And the purification phase is just basically when we lose the power, we lose the water, all the things that we're used to right now are all related to energy. You cut the power right now, you got no water, you got no way to store food, you got no way to pump gas. Civilization as we know it comes to an end. And it'll come to an end just like that, right? And that's what the Native Americans, and that's what the Hopi, and that's what the Maya are talking about. And they've been talking about these things for hundreds of years. I mean, there's a prophecy that was released with Grandfather Malava that I was working with. His father had prophecies that were taken by the Heard Museum in the 1920s, and they were just released in 2019. And he's reading these prophecies word for word that his father had written in Hopi, and they sound like a headline from the news today. Wildfires, when you see the wildfires going all over the place and da-da-da-da, and he just goes on, and you just, like, literally, it sounds like a news flash from CNN. And this is a 100-year-old document. You see? So it's coming, and people need to prepare. They really do need to prepare. I'm not a fear-monger, and I don't believe in fear, but, like, we have to be realistic that we melted all the ice caps, number one, okay? So when you melt all that ice, right, from the poles, right, it goes to the equator, right? because it's liquid now. And centrifugal, you know, pulls it to the equator. So what that causes, the Earth is actually sped up. The spin of the Earth is sped up. You can Google this. Now, it may only be a picosecond or a microsecond. But what people don't realize is force is equal to mass times acceleration. So the F is equal to the mass of the Earth times the acceleration, might be a picosecond. That F figure is equal to like 1,700 million Hiroshima bombs going off at once in terms of energy. So that energy has to be dissipated. And the way that the Earth is going to dissipate that energy is what we're seeing right now. This uptick in the earthquakes, this uptick in volcanoes, right? All of these things that we're seeing popping up all around the Earth is the expression of that release of energy, right? So, and it's going to keep on going until it basically equalizes itself, right? Until we get the Earth and the atmosphere and everything back into sort of a more or less, well, I don't think it'll ever be equal. It's always a constant change. But what I'm trying to say is that the Hopi have a story about this, okay? It was called The Story of Spider-Woman. And the story is that Spider-Woman was traveling through space and she saw the Earth, and the Earth was wobbling, right, on its axis. It wasn't at 23.5 degrees. So what she did is she took her two nephews, right, and she put the nephews at the poles of the Earth. And what that did is that stabilized the Earth, right? So we're talking about terraforming here, talking about terraforming in an ancient Hopi story. Now, Spider-Woman, she gets the Earth stabilized, and now the Earth has seasons, right? Because if you take the axis and you put it at 23.5 degrees, now it's at the same tilt as it goes around the sun. Now you have seasons, right? Before it was wobbling, you couldn't have seasons. The seasons were all messed up. The animals couldn't live. And they're describing this, right, in the book, in the story. And I said to Grandfather, I said, this is mind-boggling to me because we're talking, I'm thinking about we're working with space people right now about putting, you know, talking about the potential of putting a space shield in space to stop some of the solar energy from getting onto the poles. We refreeze the poles, we stop the methane release, and then we balance the Earth back again, and maybe we can stop some of that energy from being released, right? And I said, Grandfather, I said, I have a question for you. What does Spider-Woman look like? I said, because I get the impression, I'm just thinking that she doesn't look like Spider, does she? And he goes, no, she doesn't. I was like, so Spider-Woman travels through time and space, doesn't she? And he goes, ah, you figured it out. Because Spider-Woman is just a metaphor for time and space, which you look at on a two-dimensional diagram or piece of paper, right? We draw space coordinates in 2D. We have a net, right? Okay, it looks like a net. So to a Native American, if you were going to describe to a Native American how space-time works, right, you show them a fishing net. And if you want to show them how gravity works, you just pull down in the center of the net and you say, that's how gravity works. Space-time is flexible, see? So we have in this one story the description of terraforming, a space woman traveling through space, correcting the wobble of the Earth by freezing the poles. You know, how could they have come up with this story having all these elements if that wasn't really what happened? How would they even know that the Earth was round?
Yeah, there's lots of other. There's also lots of other corroborative evidence of like 23.5 degrees being used. Like people just measuring way back when, you know, way before even maybe pre-dynastic, but measuring the tilt of the Earth and some of these weird measurements that you're like, why are they paying attention to all these things? But there could be reasons. So what's the 3-day? How does the 3-day thing come about again?
So we'll have, so the theory is that it's basically like a super polarized magnetic field, whether it's emanating from the supermassive black hole in the middle of our galaxy or it's emanating from someplace else. My personal opinion is that it arcs out. So it comes out of the supermassive black hole at an angle, and then it basically arcs over. It's attracted through the electric arc, so to speak. That theory that gentleman has is spot on, I think. And when we pass through that period, so that your listeners understand, a superpolarized magnetic field is basically a positive and negative magnetic field that wrap around each other and twist. Okay. So if you're familiar with the right-hand rule, how electricity works, it twists as it goes forward. So that's polarized, superpolarized magnetic field. So what will happen is like light is electromagnetic. In heat, comes from the light is electromagnetic in nature, right? It's radiation. So the theory is that you think of it like a snake, right? Coming from the galaxy, the supermassive black hole of the galaxy, and then it hits the solar system. Of course, it's going to go straight to the sun because that's where the gravity is, right? So it's going to be naturally attracted to the sun, that supermassive, twisting, super powerful magnetic energy is actually going to take the light and the heat from the sun and wrap it. It's basically going to be stuck in that. Think of it like a tunnel, I guess you could say. Or if you've ever had a water hose and you put a ball at the end of the water hose, there's a great analogy. And due to this, forget what it's called, the Coriolis effect, that the ball will just stay in the middle of that airstream or the water stream. So it's sort of the exact same concept, except in this case, we're using light and energy and gravity. And so the supermassive black hole energy will wrap around the sun. And because it's so massive and so dense and it's twisting, it's going to pull the sunlight with it in the direction that it already wants to go, right? It's going to overwhelm the ability of the electromagnetic energy from the sun to reach the earth, okay? And that's where the 3 days of darkness will come. 72 hours is what they say specifically.
Yeah.
And the Mayan elders are like, no, we're good. They carry copal around. Copal is a special incense. Essentially, it comes from tree sap, right? And I asked them, you know, we did these sacred fire ceremonies. Why are we doing so many sacred fire ceremonies? We did 11 sacred fire ceremonies today. I'm covered with soot from head to toe. I was wearing a white, you know, they have this white uniform that you wear, and I'm almost black with it. And then I realized that in a situation where you lost the sunlight for 72 hours, it essentially plunged the whole earth into a deep freeze very quickly. People don't realize like how much energy is in the sun. So, you know, if you want to know what it'll be like Antarctica, or it'll be like, you know, the tip of the North Pole in the middle of the winter. So we could very easily within 72 hours see negative 60 degrees at the equator.
Right, right. Yeah, even in an eclipse, you can feel it for 2 minutes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So imagine if it was 72 hours of no heat, or no radiation from the sun whatsoever. So what will happen is we'll go into a deep freeze, and then we'll go into a deep thaw, because that superpolarized energy will then disconnect from the sun. The sun will come back, and we'll have a huge flood, right? Is the flood story. And we'll have it'll dislodge all of the you know, icebergs and whatever will dislodge. That'll cause tidal waves, and this whole thing's supposed to go on for a long time. And the Hopi said that the two oceans would meet together in the middle, meaning like it would be big enough that, you know, eventually like there would be a meeting in the middle of the country of the east of the Pacific and the Atlantic, essentially. Turtle Island is what they call America. So, yeah, these are pretty crazy, you know, wild, you know, and there's no timeline. This could be 50 years from now. This could be 100 years from now. The Hopi think, the elders that I talk to think it's going to happen right around 2028 based on the signs. And based on, you know, the things that they're seeing going on right now, they do say that it will be preceded by an unbelievably strong earthquake on the West Coast. And then about 2 weeks after that, the aftershocks from the West Coast will actually cause the New Madrid to go. And then when the New Madrid goes, we lose the grid. And then after we lose the grid, we get hit with a solar flare or something like what I just described. Yeah, that's what they said. That's the sequence of events.
Huh.
Yeah, I think the real question, do you want to live through that, right?
I want to live through anything. Yeah.
Well, the Hopi have a saying that, you know, rejoice with who you're with now, because this is the best time in all of, you know, the life of a soul to be alive, I guess is what they're trying to say. This is a very important time in history for humans, and, you know, you believe in quantum entanglement, the past, present, the future, all the same, so. I think it's all important, and it all ties in. You know, I mean, if we're looking at Phobos and Deimos and Mars, you know, we could be looking back in history at our own destruction, a story of our own destruction, to try to maybe help us understand what we might be facing now. You know,
Darren, do you got any questions at all? Or?
Do you think like NASA is onto this stuff? Or are they just dismissing it as a coincidence? Or what's the mainstream take on the inner and outer?
NASA's known about this for the Russians and Americans have known about this for decades. This is nothing new. In fact, I think actually there was a secret mission to, well, it wasn't really that secret. Phobos 1 and Phobos 2 was a joint CIA Russian mission in the 1980s that was sent to Phobos and Deimos in order to investigate some of these things. Phobos 1 was lost Phobos 2 was lost, but not before streaming back some very unusual photographs of huge UFOs that appear to be docking with Phobos. Now, here's the kicker. In one of my books, which I have yet to publish, The Norfolk Incident, I was able to put together a timeline of all these events, including the Kaidun meteorite. And I think what happened is when that mission was done, when the Phobos 2 satellite was lost, okay, that was in like 1989, we had a Russian-American summit planned with the in Iceland, actually, I think it was, with Reagan. And the summit was scheduled, interestingly enough, right after Phobos 2 was scheduled to rendezvous with Phobos. And I actually believe that they were able to learn and discover things that we're talking about right now. It's taken 30, 40 years to come out, that actually forced them to sign the SALT Treaty and the other treaties that they signed. And eventually, a year later, led to the downfall of what, you know, the former Soviet Union, because of this newly found. And remember, Reagan made that speech at the UN, too, about what if we found out that there was a, you know, a foreign enemy that was, you know, possibly, you know, a hostile threat to all of us. Would that not unite us all? And then the next thing you know, the Berlin Wall fall. So I actually think when history is written, we will look back. Someday we'll know the truth, I think, and we'll be able to read the archives someday of what actually happened with Phobos 1 and Phobos 2. And I think we'll find that that actually helped lead to the end of the Cold War, believe it or not. Oh, and one more fun fact, just to throw this out at you, just in case you think this might be a far-flung theory. Kaidun, the meteorite that it shows the evidence of the nuclear pulse detonation, fell on a Russian military base in Yemen. And I did my talk at an alien con in 2019, 2018, I think at Baltimore. And at the very end of the talk, a very learned gentleman came up to me at the end of the talk and basically said that wasn't an accident, meaning it wasn't an accident that meteorite just happened to fall onto a Russian military base in 1989. That was a more than likely a planned event with a probably a more top secret mission that we didn't know about that went to Phobos that the Russians and the Americans worked on together. They split the cost of it, essentially. So,
well, maybe we can get to some of the visual evidence of Phobos. I can share your book, some pictures from your book here.
Sure. Yeah.
We're talking about some of the like what would be something that people would, you know, like the sort of the best case or the best evidence that you have here for, I mean, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of different stuff in here. It's packed chock-a-block full of, you know.
Yeah, sure. If you want to scroll down, I think, honestly, so I had this right there. Go up a little bit. Those black, yeah, yellow and blue. So what those two are right there is a 3D printed exact scale print of Phobos and Deimos connected together.
Oops. Wow. Okay. So like the yellow one is Deimos and the blue one is Phobos.
Yeah, the big one is Phobos, and the little one is Deimos.
Yeah.
And I had been looking at photographs of these for a long time, and I have a photographic memory, an eidetic memory, and I said, wow, you know, it looks like these two could fit together. So in 2007, I put the theory together that actually Phobos and Deimos were one body, and they were split apart and by nuclear pulse detonation and put into the orbits that they're in, because it makes a lot more sense to move one big, huge body, put it into outer orbit around Mars, split them apart, and then put them into their respective orbits. So I didn't have the ability to really prove it. I were taking a lot of time in computational, you know, software that I didn't really have. And so I kind of put that idea on the backbone. Then about 2-3 years ago, I was able to get my hands on a 3D printer. And I said, well, why don't I just 3D print these to scale and just see if they fit, right? So that's what I did. So if you scroll back up to that yellow and that blue symbol, those are that's what I 3D printed out. And what I did is I moved them. I basically took them and tried to fit them together to see if they would fit. And I moved them around till I found a spot that looked like it fit perfectly. And basically what I found, yeah, that one right there. So what I found is basically about 80% of the perimeter between the two bodies was perfect. And wow. Yeah, while WoW is beyond, it's beyond WoW. And then also in addition to that, you know, there's only a very small area between the two, about 20% that wasn't matching up. And that's probably where they split it. So they basically drilled some holes around. This is what's called a binary asteroid. So there are certain asteroids which are called binary asteroids, which are basically two asteroids that melted together when they were kind of forming, but it wasn't a high impact collision. So it's basically two bodies that melted together. And what they did is they sought out a body like this and they split it apart. So the blue is actually, I took some clay model, some modeling clay, and I put it over the outside of the two so you would get an idea of what it would probably look like before they split it apart. And so this basically proves to me, as far as I'm concerned, that these two are actually part of the same body. I call it Pandemos, and they were actually split apart and put into their respective orbits. And there's evidence of these, of the splitting on Deimos, where they, you can actually see on the bottom part, you can't really see in that photograph too well, but there are other photographs where you see a starburst pattern on the bottom, and that's where that part was blown apart from Phobos, which is much bigger. Now, the crazy thing about this is that actually also explains Stickney Crater. So Stickney Crater is this huge crater on the side of Phobos, and scientists couldn't really explain how it was formed.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to pull up a picture of Stickney, there you go. That's Stickney Crater right there. Right there, yep. So Deimos basically fits into that crater. See?
Yeah.
And almost perfectly. Almost, that's the crazy thing. It almost fits perfectly. So much so that no, I don't think anyone could ever like think, you have to play with them in your hands to see how, you know, how well they do fit together, that they could say that they didn't fit together. Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah. Yeah. Now this one right here is a great photo. So you see those striations on the moon?
Yeah.
Yep. Those are called, I forget what they're called, but basically they're pockets of molten rock that was forced across the surface of the moon, and these changed direction. And people have been puzzled by how these could form. Well, the reason why you have these striations in the moon is because when they split apart Pandemos to make two separate moons, they used nuclear pulse detonation. So every time they set off a nuclear bomb, the debris that was between the bomb and the planet was thrown back towards the planet in molten form, and that's why you see these streaks, because that's from the nuclear pulse detonations going off. Boom, 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 boom. And now keep in mind the Phobos is probably turning on its axis, right? So as it's turning, you have an explosion. Now it looks like the line's coming from a different angle, but it's not really. It's just that Phobos was turning as the explosion went off. So the radial pattern changes in relationship to where the bomb went off. So that explains all of those anomalies all over the surface of Phobos. Explains them 100%.
Huh. Where's this picture come from with the lines on it like that?
It's either NASA or ESA. It's one of the two.
Go ahead, Graham.
Well, Will 2022 is asking about, I don't know if I want to take us too far off these pictures here, but he says, bring up Arrokoth in the Kuiper Belt. I don't know if you know what Arrokoth is. It must be an asteroid in the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah, I'm not sure. He might be talking about a binary in the asteroid belt. Okay. Sounds to me.
All right, let's move on here then with these ones here. So what's this one? That looks like a cool spot.
So that's just a, I believe it was an infrared radiographic image showing the leading edge of the planet, the asteroid. So one of the interesting things about this is that it's, I forget the exact technical term for it, but essentially as it's going around Mars, it basically faces in the same direction as it goes around Mars. So it's not tumbling and it's not falling over. It's basically has the same face to the same side of Mars all the time as it goes around it.
And it goes around it this way, the leading side, and that's the Mars is over here, and it just goes around.
Correct. Which is what you want if it's an orbiting space platform. You don't want it spinning. You want it like you want to know exactly where you can dock with it. So that's what we would expect. Now, if it was a naturally captured asteroid, we would not expect that. We would expect it to be just all over the place, you know, spinning wildly. And the orbit would be eccentric as well. That's a great photo. So that's a color enhanced photo. So you see that white? So that's one of the areas where one of the bombs went off, and they were probably trying to correct its spin or its rotation. And so they put it off to the side of the planet, and that is essentially the blast wave pattern that we see that would come from the nuclear pulse detonation. And there would be multiple detonations, not just one. There would be boom, boom. Oh, have you heard of or seen the Netflix three-body problem?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you remember that whole thing where they're talking about nuclear pulse detonation? This is it.
Yeah. Trying to get it through the. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is nuclear pulse detonation. This, when the three-body problem, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Someone in the world will know what I'm talking about now. But this is exactly how nuclear pulse detonation would work. And you see how there's all these pits and everything on there? If you look at Deimos, Deimos has a lot of dust, and all of those holes have been filled in, so it's very smooth. Whereas on Phobos, it's a lot more hilly. You see those sort of cracks, they call them rills. That's the evidence of the nuclear pulse detonation. So the reason why Deimos has more dust is because Deimos was placed into an outer orbit, and it was much smaller. So you don't need as many nuclear pulses to keep it where you want it. But in order to get Phobos, which is like 4 or 5 times the size of Deimos, into the lower orbit, they had to fire off a lot more bombs to slow it down to get it into that lower orbit and to get it into the position that they wanted. So all of the dust on Phobos is gone, but most of the dust on Deimos is still there.
Is there any pictures of the monolith in here at all? I tried to find one earlier and I couldn't.
Yeah, it should be. I if you keep on going, I separated them. It should be like coming up soon.
The monolith. Did you say what you think the monolith was for? Do you think they were using that to like tow stuff around or?
Well, no.
I guess you said you thought it might actually just have some actual inscription on it.
It could. Well, it's a very tall. Apparently, it's about 300 feet tall and about 100 feet wide, and it sticks out from the surface pretty far. Now, there's basically, as far as I'm concerned, I have two theories for it. One is that it is a monolith or some kind of structure that was built by someone, possibly like some kind of docking platform or something like that, right? The other possibility is that it's some kind of artifact or debris that was blown back into Phobos when they split apart. There you go. There it is right there. When they split apart the two pieces, there might have been a chunk that just got, you know, thrown back into the planet. But here's the crazy thing about that. If that were true, you would expect it to be some kind of debris field around the monolith, like a crater, so to speak, of where it hit. So that kind of pushes it back into the, you know, a possibly artificial structure, right?
It is quite the anomaly.
Yeah, and it's very tall. It's hard. Obviously, it's impossible to get an idea.
Well, look at the shadow. Yeah, look at how long the shadow is there.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the estimate was 300 meters by 100 meters, which is, 300 feet by 100 feet. Which is big. I mean, it's a 30-story building, you know, 100 feet wide. It's not, you know, it's a significant structure. So you see how you have those, all of those, they look like cracks. And the mystery has always been, how do you get a crack that goes all the way around without it breaking it up, right? And so there were a lot of theories put forth where they thought maybe it was struck by something that caused Stickney Crater. But then they did the computations and they figured out, well, if it was that big and it hit the thing, it would blow it up into a million pieces. So they couldn't explain how Stickney Crater was there. But then if you look at the way those patterns are, and you imagine a bomb going off, you know, and creating those patterns, then it's obvious, you know. And it explains how those could change patterns and change direction. Because it's not that the pattern itself is changing direction. What's happening is that the planet is spinning as bombs are going off. So as the bombs are going off, the planet is spinning, and as the planet spins, it changes the direction of the debris field. Not the debris field itself changes direction, but the planet is spinning and moving.
Yeah. The moon. Yeah,
I know. We're the planet moon.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that these ones are hollow?
Yes, actually. The Russians did a bunch of radiographic test on it in the 60s, and it was way, it definitely wasn't dense enough. So they do think it is hollow, or hollowed out, let's say, not hollow, but you know what I mean? And there's a reason for that. There's actually a really good reason for that, because people don't realize that in space you get cosmic radiation and all kinds of things that can kill you and make you sick and you can die from. And if you take an asteroid and you hollow it out and you put your space base inside of the asteroid, then you've got free protection from micrometeorites, from impacts, from all kinds, from radiation. So the best way to do large transfers of anything in space is to take an asteroid and hollow it out. And there's your space station.
Yeah, there's a bunch of theories that people are saying that, you know, all these civilizations out there are just underneath these planets, inside the planets, inside all the caves and tunnels and stuff. And like the outside of the planet is more of a rare visit type thing. It's like Eden. Yeah. Eden, yeah, as compared to like where you normally live, because of all these dangers, really.
I have a theory behind that, actually. When I was working with Grandfather Malaver and the Hopi elders, you know, we talked a lot about the different ages. So, for instance, like they believe that there's been five previous cataclysms, right? Yeah. Five previous extinctions. And we know this from the record, right? It's accurate, right? So how could they know that there were five previous extinctions unless, like, either someone told them or they lived through it, or someone told them that they lived through it? I don't know. But they knew it without science, right? So they also have about five or six indigenous species that they communicate with and that live underground, right? So I thought, well, what if every time there was a prime species on the planet, any planet, and we have these cyclical events, whether it's asteroid strike or, you know, melting poles, et cetera. And every time there was an extinction level event, they went underground. And then the next species takes over on the ground, and then they have an extinction level event, and then they go underground. Long story short, if there was five extinction level events on the Earth, and there's five species that live under the Earth, I'm thinking that those are the five Earth species that are indigenous to Earth and had to go underground during the last, you know, cataclysm.
Couple million years or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. Which would explain why they have this relationship with them, and perhaps why the Ant people came to help the Hopi, right? And tell them that these things were coming, which is amazing. They must have high technology that we don't really understand. Oh, wait. See that picture there on the bottom with Deimos? Yep. See that starburst pattern?
Yeah.
That was the first thing that made me think, what if that was attached to Phobos, and that's evidence of an explosion that exploded out from a central core and blew the two planets apart? And that's the face right there that fits into Stickney.
Wow, yeah, that's crazy.
You see how it fits?
I was going to ask you, when you mentioned the 80-20, if there was anything that, you know, in the 20 that showed markings or anything like that.
No, it basically just looks like a part that was probably the weakest part of the connection between the two, so to speak. Yeah. And they just like we would do, we would just drill holes down, and then we pack it with dynamite, and then we do a sequential blast, and we break it off. And if you look at Stickney Crater, it's pretty perfect, right? If you look at it, and you wouldn't necessarily get that from a strike, right? And if it was big enough to cause that kind of an impact, it would more than likely destroy the whole planet. That's why Stickney Crater is more evidence of an explosion, not a strike implosion, if that makes sense. You know? So it wasn't a compaction event, it was an explosive event that separated the two. Basically, you just took a natural occurring crack and you just created more of a crack. And then once you separated them a little bit, then you'd blow up another bomb and another bomb and another bomb. And of course, every time you blew up a bomb inside of the crater that you formed where Deimos was, you essentially are concentrating it, using it like a nozzle to concentrate the energy towards Deimos. So obviously, like, there was a lot of preparation and planning that went into this, because you could tell how perfectly they did it. You know, the evidence is there. As an engineer and as a builder myself, I'm fascinated by it, because I look at this and I'm like, wow, they thought of everything. You know, they really knew what they were doing.
There's the shadow, right?
Well, I think that's a UFO, isn't it? Or is that's not the, Is that the is that the monolith, or is that some of these UFO pictures?
Well, no, that's actually a shadow on Mars, which they believe is the shadow of the UFO.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. That UFO that you're that they're showing all these pictures of.
Correct. So that's Marina Popovich. She's one of the most decorated female astronauts in Russia. And that's the press conference they did in 1989 where they were releasing this information. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome that you included these old pictures in your book here.
Yeah.
Is that Phobos that's next to you?
Yeah. Yeah. She's got a picture of Phobos, and there's a 32 kilometer long UFO, like basically trying to dock with it, is what it looks like.
And that's looking for a monolith.
Yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. That could be what the monolith is for, actually. It could be if you look at the dirigibles back in the old days, you know, you would basically have a huge mass type thing, and you would just, obviously, there's no air there. So, you know, it could just basically float there and connect to it. Yeah.
Huh. Imagine that.
Yeah, back in the day when they could actually, like, have a conference and talk about UFO pictures before they clamped down in the 90s and 2000s, really. Now we're back to like some openness of it, I guess.
I mean, that was like 1991, I think, roughly 92, yeah. 93, maybe. I mean, you might have been able to find those pictures in like a couple obscure UFO magazines, but it's nothing like what we have today, you know?
Yeah.
I think it was like 99 when you can start downloading them from NASA.
Yeah, right. Yeah, 2 days.
William, is there anything you feel like we didn't get to from the book that you'd like to get out?
No, I think just for everyone to keep an open mind. Obviously, when the book is available, love for everyone to get a copy of it. I think these are important topics, not just for the human race, but I think for the future of the human race.
What is that?
That's Orion. So that was the government's plan to do nuclear pulse detonation through ships. Remember the three-body problem?
Right. I didn't see it.
Yeah, no, Project Orion was a real thing. And when they were talking about, you know, Project Orion, that was a real government program to use nuclear pulse detonation. These are the plans for it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah. So... It's you know, and they put a lot of money into it too. You know, the only reason why they didn't do it is because they used too much pushback for exploding nuclear bombs in the atmosphere. But I mean, it's technically feasible, and it would be the best way to get it into space,
to Mars and beyond.
Yeah. Well, here's the crazy thing, right? Now, you know, NASA's got a penchant for how should I say it, hiding things in plain sight. So. That's a 50 or 60, 70 year old project, right? Project Orion. Well, what's the name of the project right now to go back to Mars?
No way.
Project Orion.
Wow.
And Apollo.
How does that thing work? It just like wedges itself in and keeps blowing up.
So you see that? Stay right there for a sec. So you see that? That's a pusher plate to the left. See, yeah, that's a pusher plate. Well, that's just a big, huge metal shock absorber. And those tubes right there are shock absorbers. So what you do is you explode a nuclear bomb behind it, and it imparts pressure on the pusher plate, and it pushes the spacecraft through space. So you basically see that little tube down by your X? So they have nuclear bombs. Yep, they shoot it down that little nozzle, and they explode it at a certain distance and a certain kiloton level behind the pusher plate. The pusher plate absorbs the excess kinetic energy, And it basically pushes it through space. And you can theoretically reach pretty close to the, you know, speed of light with this.
How do you stop?
Turn it around and explode bombs in the opposite direction. That's it.
Yeah. William, where can people get this? Where can they get the book? Where can they follow you on social media? Do you have any websites or anything like that where they can track you down?
I know, you know, all I have really right now is my encrypted email address, which is my name, WilliamWarwick@pm.me. Feel free to drop me a line, and I would be happy to send you a copy of our book.
Yeah, there's some good pictures of the monolith here, yeah.
The monolith is quite the enigma. I mean, at first, the thing you're like, yeah, But then the more you look at it, you're like, well, it does look pretty artificial. It's pretty hard to argue that it's not fake. I mean, it looks like a little, it says it's 279 feet tall.
Yeah. I mean, that's a 30 story building. That's a contact binary. So that's a real asteroid. So if you look in between the two, yeah, all you got to do is drill that out, separate them. And that makes sense, right? You wouldn't go to the trouble of like getting two separate asteroids from the asteroid belt.
Right.
You would find one. Yeah, it's economy of scale. You got to think like an alien. And an alien is going to do the most efficient thing possible, right?
I wonder if they were trying to mine him and one got away from him and just fucking wrecked the place.
That big possibly, thing. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, though, because what if they were trying to mine them and perhaps they couldn't stop or something malfunctioned? And that's what caused those big, huge
rifts in Mars, right? It looks like it got hammered by something really hard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, it's a great mystery there. I think we're going to find, you know, I think we might find that some of the stories that we think happened on Earth actually happened on Mars, like the Ark of the Covenant and, you know, the Ark story and Noah and all that. What if the Noah story was really that Mars was being destroyed and flooded or whatever, and they had to leave there to come to Earth?
And are we close to capital D disclosure right now? Is it going to happen?
We've been in disclosure for a while. It's just going to take time. Like this is part of disclosure right here.
Yeah.
You know, but they're going to do it. A decision was made a long time ago that they're just going to dole this out little by little by little so that it's not such a huge impact on society. It's the only way they could do it. And even like from the energy standpoint, like I was really, when I was younger, I was naive about it. I'm like, why don't they release, you know, all the technology? And the reason why they don't do that, let's just say you had free energy. Let's say you had a device that cost $5 and it gave you unlimited free energy. What do you think that would have? What kind of effect do you think that would have on the world economy? You've got probably 20 or 30% of the world is completely dependent on oil and gas production. America, I mean, 80% of the world's oil and gas now comes from America, right? So, or Nigeria or wherever, right? OPEC, right? Iran, Iraq. Look at all the countries that are already unstable. Now let's take away their only source of income because we've got this new free energy device. Yeah. So, while environmentally, yes, we need these things, you know, economically, it would be great for the end users. But if you really look at it from world point of view,
a collapse point of view, yeah.
A collapse point of view, you can't do that. And if we do it, we've got to do it in a controlled fashion because the shock, the economic shock, the socioeconomic shock will be so great that it'll just cause chaos.
And so, well, hopefully they get on it. I mean, I don't know. They seem to be a little too slow for my liking.
Well, that's because, well, like Neil says, it would end slavery, and we can't have that.
Well, you know, look, you know, you guys, you know your history, right? You know history. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, you know, we've gone into a situation where we give absolute power to, you know, certain elements of the United States government within and without, and they created their own government, right? And now they're probably, I mean, you can make an argument that it's probably not a bad thing, right? Because we're still here, right? So, you know, as long as we're still here, we have time to figure it out. That's my so. I think at the end of the day, we could argue whether or not these things should have been done, but we're still here.
Yeah,
and we still speak in American. We're not speaking Russian and Chinese yet. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's okay. So
yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. I don't know.
Yeah, what's the alternative? You know what I mean? What is the alternative? Chaos? So I think the slow roll.
Well, no, the alternative is like less corruption at least, and less like bilking trillions for a climate change thing. That's like, you know, I mean, we pay taxes in Canada that are off the chain, right? I mean, we were paying carbon taxes through the nose. So we have a different view than you Americans down there, probably, because we're getting hosed to death up here based on a big fat lie. So that's what's frustrating for me. Like that's
you know, I don't want to burst your bubble, but everyone's getting screwed. Yeah. And there's the purpose of government and politics is to divide people so that they can divide and conquer the spoils of war, so to speak. So. Yeah, a lot of those things are going to be taken care of by the blockchain and by digital currency, actually. I know a lot of people, they don't understand Bitcoin and understand digital currency or this, that, and the other thing. And maybe some people are afraid that it's going to lead to, you know, they're going to be able to monitor everything. But when you talk about corruption and you talk about like AML, which is anti-money laundering, and I'm real big into finance and stuff like that, you know, the only way that you can stop those kind of, that kind of corruption is with something like a blockchain transaction system, you know, a decentralized ledger system where it's transparent. So like, if we give money to a country in Africa, we give them $1 billion, right? And it's supposed to be trickled down on the people. And then, you know, less than 100 million trickles down on the people. You know, when you give someone a big fat check like the World Bank does, it says, oh, here's $1 billion, right? There's no way to know where those dollars are going.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah.
You can't track it. But with the Bitcoin system and the crypto system, the way it's set up with the blockchain and everything, we can track all of that. So we can give $1 billion to a developing nation and with the absolute intent that it's supposed to go here, here, and here, and we can track it and make sure that it does go where it's supposed to go. And if it doesn't go where it's supposed to go, we can pull it back and we can stop it, right? And we can't do that with the current system that we have. We can't do that with SWIFT, you know, or dollars or whatever. So I think
we can just get them to actually borrow money and we could just take care of ourselves for a bit. That would be maybe for a decade or two, that like let other people borrow the money and go into debt. We've been into debt for long enough. So take care of us. And then we'll worry about the rest of the people because we got people dying left, right, and center on the streets here. And that's not good. So,
you know, it's not good. The system is set up to take.
Yeah.
The system is set up to pull and to take and to graft, essentially, right? Because what is business, right? What business is, someone has to make a profit off of everything, right? That's, otherwise, we all have to eat. So whenever we sell our goods and services, we have to make a profit off. The problem is that at the very top levels, you know, the government levels, the political levels, in every country, I don't care what country you're in, there's corruption. And it's gotten so bad and it's gotten so out of control. Like in America, we've got a $68 trillion debt. Now they say it's 14, 15, 30 trillion. It's not. It's two or three times that size, right? They don't include Social Security. And then, you know, they do some creative accounting. We're never going to be able to pay that debt off conventionally. Now we will be able to pay it off if we convert to a stable coin and then we use the stable coin value to basically offset the national debt over time as the stable coin crypto value goes up, which is essentially what they're trying to do right now. And that probably will be successful, but it'll take a while, right? But the beauty of everything that's coming down the pipeline that I see is that technology got us into this place we're in right now, all these problems that we have. And the reason for that is because the technology increased much faster than society was ready to adapt to it, you know? And that's still a big problem. But I think we're kind of reaching a sort of crescendo here where, you know, the average person, you know, has access to a smartphone now. And if you've got access to a smartphone in most countries, you can access anything. You know, I mean, I if my kids were young today, I would say, you know, why go to college? Just get a YouTube account. You know, YouTube anything you want. $35 a month versus 150 grand, get a YouTube account, Google anything, get ChatGPT. ChatGPT will sit there and tell you anything you want to know about anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe technology will get us out of this mess. It's interesting. Interesting view.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I reserve judgment. William Warwick, sorry. This has been great. Come back again. We'll do this again down the road.
Love you guys. Definitely. We got a couple more books coming out. Phoenix Incident, The Covenant, The Norfolk Incident. The Third Secret of Fatima.
Oh, cool.
All kinds of good stuff. Yeah.
Right on, buddy. Yeah, when those come out, let us know.
Absolutely.
All right, buddy. Thanks.
Take care. Appreciate it. Have a good one, guys.
Yeah, see ya.
Take
care. Oops. Sorry, William. And that was our chat with William Warwick, the Phobos Enigma. What'd you say?
Yeah. That's good to come full circle.
Yeah, that's crazy. What is this? Episode 706 or something like that, right? So come back. We must have touched on it a little bit there, in between a little bit too, maybe.
Oh, yeah, a little bit.
I wonder, we didn't get into the stains. I mean, I haven't looked at the stains in a long time. They must have better pictures of them. Did Elon have over any yet?
Imagine now you don't have to download them all individually and put them all together, stitch them all together on dial-up.
Remember when the rover found some trash and they tried to tell us it was just the trash from the other rover from before? Like, oh, well, this is a little smaller than Earth, so I guess.
Well, what'd you think about that Blue Origin thing? Did you think? Did you hear about the door thing where Bezos had to open the door with a tool, but they had already opened it from the inside, and everybody's like, "It's fake! It's fake!"
I'm trying not to
Go there.
I'm trying. I haven't seen it yet. The Weissman asked me if I watched it just before the show, and I was like, "Nah, I haven't. I don't care."
It's pretty funny. It's pretty gross, actually. It's a big PR stunt, but to me, that doesn't mean the whole trip was fake. It just means that they're trying to make it seem like it's all techie with him opening it from the outside, and Bezos needs his 2 minutes in the limelight. It's kind of it was gross from that part of it, but it doesn't mean the whole thing is fake. That's where But they're like, the door can't open inwards; it has to open outwards.
It's a lie. It's all lies. I mean, that's the thing. They lied so much, you can't rule anything out.
Everything's a conspiracy now.
At this point. Big thanks to William for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you're one of our lords or our ladies or people that support the show or nobles, any of them, all of the above. Head over to grimeamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation, and we would be all giddy and happy. And his ground's fucked it up again. And head over to adultbrain.ca for all of our audiobooks and ebooks and print books and all the great stuff over there. We'll publish your book for you if you want. This is Grimerica. We have grimericaoutlawed.ca for other content. A little darker over there sometimes. Contact at the cabin for trips and events. I think we're down to like we got another spot gone today for a trip with Randall next month in a few weeks. So if you want to get in on that, you better get in on it. There's only a few spots left. And then we got some other great trips coming after that. And of course, head over to GrimericaCBD.com to explore the mysteries of the CBD universe. You can get tinctures and gummies and all sorts of good stuff. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
I'm walking gingerly through the rat race. Take a look at the big old smile on my face. Kicking around down by the pool of narcissists. The people are many, they preen themselves, oh how they navel gaze. Somewhere over that hill, the gloomy skies cease to exist. I'm climbing that hill, I pass by and pity the poor Sisyphus. I go into hyperdrive, turn into a beam of light. I'm strolling down aesthetic electric avenue. The people are predictable, they say good morning, how do you do? When out of nowhere a randomly pure angel in the crosswalk bumps into me, and in doing so knocks all the evil and all the wind out of me. And it's black as tar, ugly as ever, and of no apology. This angelic mama sings heavenly of the truest theology. Together we're a seraphim dream, forever young with no chronology. 1,000 years from now we'll be written into ancient mythology. We go into hyperdrive, turn into a beam of light. Can you tell me about the view up there? It's sparkling remarkably, the air is crystal clear. Well, please won't you tell me what it takes to transcend this place? A little bit of heart and a whole lot of soul. Take a look at the big old smile on my face. My angel says, dance with me and your life will never, ever, ever be dull. I go into hyperdrive, turn into a beam of light. 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 We'll be right back.